In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord delivered Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, along with some of the articles from the temple of God. These he carried off to the temple of his God in Babylonia and put in the treasure house of his God. Then the king ordered Ashpenaz, chief of his court officials, to bring into the king's service some of the Israelites from the royal family and the nobility, young men without any physical defect, handsome, showing aptitude for every kind of learning, well-informed, quick to understand, and qualified to serve in the king's palace. He was to teach them the language and literature of the Babylonians. The king assigned them a daily amount of food and wine from the king's table. They were to be trained for 3 years, and after that, they were to enter the king's service. Among those who were chosen were some from Judah: Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. The chief official gave them new names: to Daniel, the name Belteshazzar; to Hananiah, Shadrach; to Mishael, Meshach; and to Azariah, Abednego. But Daniel resolved not to defile himself with the royal food and wine, and he asked the chief official for permission not to defile himself in this way. Now God had caused the official to show favor and compassion to Daniel. But the official told Daniel, "I'm afraid of my lord the king, who has assigned your food and drink. Why should he see you looking worse than other young men of your age? The king would then have my head because of you." Daniel then said to the guard, whom the chief official had appointed over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, "Please test your servants for 10 days. Give us nothing but vegetables to eat and water to drink. Then compare our appearance with that of the young man who eat the royal food, and treat your servants in accordance with what you see." So he agreed to do this and tested them for 10 days. At the end of the 10 days, they looked healthier and better nourished than any of the young men who ate the royal food. So the guard took away their choice food and the wine they were to drink and gave them vegetables instead. To these four young men, God gave knowledge and understanding of all kinds of literature and learning. And Daniel could understand visions and dreams of all kinds. At the end of the time set by the king to bring him into his service, the chief official presented him to Nebuchadnezzar. The king talked with him, and he found none equal to Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. So they entered the king's service. In every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king questioned them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters in his whole kingdom. And Daniel remained there until the first year of King Cyrus.
Thanks very much, Ines, for reading for us. Let's have that open in front of us. If you can find a church Bible, keep it open at Daniel Chapter 1, page 844. There's the title, "When We Feel the Pressure to Conform." You probably heard this story before. It's a well-known story. It's probably not a true story. A trainee police officer was taking their final exam, and he came to this question on the paper. "There's an explosion nearby. You see a large hole in the road with an overturned van. Both passengers are unconscious. There's a strong smell of drink from the driver, who you recognise. The driver is married to your chief inspector. He's away, she's with another man. A member of the public offers assistance. You recognise him too, he's wanted for several armed robberies. Just at that moment, a man runs from the house saying his wife is in shock from the explosion and she's starting to give birth. Another man is crying for help. He's been thrown into the river by the explosion and he can't swim. Bearing in mind the provisions of the Mental Health Act, describe what actions you would take." The student thought quietly for a moment, picked up his pen and wrote, I would take off my uniform and blend in with the crowd. As Christians, we're often tempted to blend in with the crowd. Sometimes it's difficult. Sometimes it's challenging. And it's just easier to go along with everyone else, to not be noticed, to avoid the challenges and responsibilities of living a distinctively Christian life. It's just easier to go along with the way that others think and the things they say and the way they live. And our Bible reading gives us real help with that and takes us back to the truth that we need to hold on to and live by in all of that. And in fact, you could sum up the whole book of Daniel in just two words. We will say a few more than two words about it, but if I had to choose just two, these are the words that I would choose. God rules. God rules. We'll actually be reading the book of Daniel over the next few months in our small groups on Sundays. There's lots to take from it. But the big issue to take away is to recognize that in a world where it often doesn't look like it or feel like it, God is the one who is in control. His kingdom and the kingdom of Jesus Christ lasts forever. And because his kingdom is forever, because it's everlasting, because God is the king in charge of all things, it is always better and always more wise to live his way and live for him. We join that kingdom when we come to know Jesus, when we decide that we're going to live under the authority of Jesus, make Jesus our Lord and King. That's what it means to be a Christian, to say, I want Jesus in charge of my life. We join that kingdom, the same kingdom that we're reading about in the book of Daniel, and the kingdom that lasts forever under Jesus. And the challenge is to live as people who belong to that kingdom, to keep our nerve and stay loyal to him. So let's look at how that works out at the beginning of the story of Daniel in chapter 1. God rules firstly when others seem powerful. That's what the first few verses are about. God rules when others seem powerful. When other leaders or other values seem to have more influence and more sway in the time that we're living. So chapter 1 begins like this. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. You might already be a bit lost with all the names and places there. The king that is mentioned there, the king of Judah, that's the king of God's kingdom. So this is guy is an ancestor of Jesus who lived many hundreds of years before Jesus. And at that point, God's people are all living together in a place called Judah, in a city called Jerusalem, and they have a king appointed by God to be their king. And God is actually the real king. He has a sort of palace of his own. The word palace and the word temple are the same in the language of the Old Testament. That's where his throne is, that's where he's king, and that's where he's ruled from. But now there's this very powerful guy called Nebuchadnezzar. He's king of Babylon. Babylon is the big power of the day. They've got all the money, they've got all the armies and all the soldiers, and they are traveling around the area and conquering and taking control. And that's what they now do to Jerusalem. They come to Jerusalem, and they surround Jerusalem with their armies, and they win. And not only that, they sort of slap God in the face by going into his temple, his palace, getting some of the nice gold and silver things and taking those off to Babylon and putting them in their own little temple to their idols, their fake gods. And that's what verse 2 says. The Lord delivered Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, along with some of the articles from the temple of God. These he carried off to the temple of his God in Babylonia and put in the treasure house of his God. But notice those really important words at the beginning of verse 2. The Lord delivered. In other words, there were very powerful, impressive people who looked as if they were in control and looked as if they were winning. But all along, this was part of God's plan. They could only do what they did because the Lord allowed it to happen. The rest of the Old Testament explains a bit the background to that, why God allowed that to happen. We won't go into that now. The important thing for us to take from it is that God rules even when others seem powerful. Well, I wonder who seems to have the power in your life. Is it your employer, your university, maybe. Maybe there are people in your family or people amongst your group of friends, and things always turn out the way they say and everything goes their way. Maybe that's the governments of the world and it's their power that worries you. Maybe it's the politicians. We need to hold on to the often hidden reality that behind all of that, the Lord is in control. So God rules when others seem powerful, verses 1 and 2. And God rules when there's pressure to conform, in verses 3 to 7. When it feels to us to be easier to be just like people who are not believers and think and act and live in the way that they think and act and live. So verse 3. Then the king, that's the king of Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar, the kind of guy who's against God, he ordered Ashpenaz, chief of his court officials, to bring into the king's service some of the Israelites from the royal family and the nobility, young men without any physical defect, handsome, showing aptitude for every kind of learning, well-informed, quick to understand, and qualified to serve in the king's palace. This is quite a clever strategy. This is a good way, if you ever feel like you want to become a kind of despotic, conquering ruler, this is a good tip, this is what you should do. You don't want the kind of little towns, the little villages to rise up and rebel against you. So what you do is you go there, you go to places like Jerusalem, and you think, well, who out of these people will be the next leaders? Who will be the future generation that everyone's going to follow? You know, in those days they picked the royalty, the nobility. It was the men, I'm afraid, perhaps more likely to lead a rebellion than the women were in those days. The ones that were good-looking, that everybody would think was popular. The ones that were clever and sharp and quick. So you select out of those people. You think, well, that's the next generation of leaders. And you take them to your own city, take them away to Babylon, and you turn them into loyal Babylonians. You kind of brainwash them and win them over and get them on your team working for you. And then you dealt with the problem, a kind of assimilation and control. It's something that's often happened throughout history. And the king of Babylon, he's got three strategies to kind of transform them into loyal Babylonian servants of the king. The first one is education. Education, privilege, and identity, as I put up on the screen. The first one is education, verse 4. At the end of verse 4, he was to teach them the language and literature of the Babylonians. Get them learning to speak and read the Babylonian language instead of their own. Get them reading all of the best literature. And it's a sort of 3-year undergraduate degree, a kind of fast-track government trainee scheme. The king of Babylon knows that if he controls their education, he can win over their thoughts and their minds. We mustn't make the mistake today of thinking that education is a neutral thing. That when you go to school or when you go to university, the only thing you're being taught is facts and information that can't really be challenged and that everyone has to agree with. Evidence always has to be interpreted. Different cultures and different societies will take the same facts and the same information and read them in different ways. And when you're learning and studying, you start with assumptions. You start with basic beliefs that you haven't discovered. You just started with them and assumed them. And if one of those assumptions is that we're living in a universe with no God and no creator and no God in control, well, that is a pretty big thing to get wrong. That's going to have a kind of knock-on impact on lots of the other ideas that you have. I was drinking a coffee in one of the local cafes on Friday, and I overheard a conversation. There was a mum, a child just come out of the local school, and they'd had some school book that I guess they were told to read with their child, and they were reading it, and I just overheard it was a story all about why you should kind of recycle toilet paper because of the trees and what that does for the environment and all of that. And nothing wrong with that message, you know, I agree with that, but I thought to myself, children's books have changed. I probably wasn't read a book like that when I was that age. And now probably there's a lot of books like that that are being read to children. And that might be fine because we don't really disagree with that particular message. But it is important to realize that our thinking and our attitudes are being shaped from a very young age by our education. And each culture and each society will do that in a different way. And they won't be starting with God. It won't always be good things that are harmless. It will shape the way that we think, for good or for bad. Education. That's his first strategy. His second one is privilege. Verse 5. The king assigned them a daily amount of food and wine from the king's table. They were to be trained for 3 years, and after that they were to enter the king's service. So they're given special food, from same food the king eats, from his own table, the very best in the world, the oldest wines, the most expensive cheeses, kind of delicious meats and fish from all over the many different countries that he controls. And to eat that food would have been a kind of great status symbol. In Daniel chapter 11, there's a mention of a different king, and the writer is sort of shocked that he was betrayed by people who ate from his own table, because that's your kind of inner circle, that's your most loyal and faithful team of followers. And still today, we often go along with other people because of that status that it gives us, to be included, to be part of the elite, to be in the inner circle, the trusted ones, the loyal ones, whether it's street gangs that share the same tattoo or the same graffiti symbol that they spray on the wall where they've been, whether it's particular expensive schools and universities that have the same pattern on their tie or the same pattern on their cufflinks, so that you know you're part of that same elite group. Loyalty and allegiance is rewarded. We're offered bribery and flattery to be like others and to think and act like them, be loyal to them. Education, privilege, and then thirdly, identity in verse 6. Among those chosen were some from Judah: Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. The chief official gave them new names: to Daniel, the name Belteshazzar; to Hananiah, Shadrach; to Mishael, Meshach; and to Azariah, Abednego. Now, all four of these young men have good Jewish names, names with meaning. I wonder if, just put your hand up if you know the meaning of your name. A lot of us might have a name with a meaning. Does anyone know what their names mean? Yeah, quite a few. I'd say maybe a half, or maybe more than a half. It was a big thing in Old Testament times. People knew what their names meant. And all four of these names have the word God kind of included in their name. So some of them end with El. Did you notice that? Daniel, Mishael. And that word El from Elohim means God. Others end with an Iah sound: Hananiah, Azariah. You've got others like that in the Bible: Isaiah, Jeremiah, Hezekiah. Another name for God there at the end of the word in the original language. But then the Babylonians said, we're going to change your name. Your name won't have your God in it. They changed their names. These names, they were given probably the names of Babylonian gods. Some of them certainly were the names of Babylonian gods. It's a way of saying how you'll be known, how you identify, who you belong to. Well, what is your identity? How do people know you? Are you known as a Christian? It's great, isn't it, for people to say, oh, that person, they're a Christian. They're associated with Christ. They belong to Jesus. But it's very easy in a culture that doesn't really recognize that, doesn't really understand that, to keep that part of ourselves quite well hidden and to put a lot of emphasis on the things that we have in common with other people and not the ways that we're different. God rules then when others seem powerful. God rules when there's pressure to conform. And God rules when we resolve to say no, when we decide not to do something that is normal for people who are not believers. And that's verses 8 to 16. So just look at verse 8. But Daniel resolved not to defile himself with the royal food and wine. And he asked the chief official for permission not to defile himself in this way. And then verse 16. So the guard took away their choice food and the wine they were to drink and gave them vegetables instead. So why did Daniel refuse to eat the food from the king's table? Was he following Old Testament kosher food laws? Well, probably. But it wasn't just that, because he refused to drink the wine, and there's no problem with drinking wine in the Old Testament food laws. Was he avoiding foods that had been sacrificed to Babylonian idols and fake gods? Well, yes, probably, but it wasn't just that, because Daniel ate vegetables, and Babylonians would have sacrificed vegetables to their gods as well as meat. The key to this, I think, is what we saw in verse 5 already. The problem with this food is that it's royal food. It's food from the king's table. This is part of the king's strategy. This is part of his flattery and his bribery. This food is saying, my first loyalty, my first allegiance now is to number one enemy to God, the king of Babylon. But Daniel's allegiance and loyalty is already taken. He belongs to God. This food that is meant to be a kind of delicious treat and privilege, he's saying, well, this would defile me. It's a strong word, isn't it? Defile. He's saying, if I accept the bribe, if my loyalty changes, rather than enjoying these delicious things, I'm actually, it's like people talk about bribery being dirty money. It's something that would defile me and spoil my loyalty to God. It's not that the Bible ever forbids him to eat this food. It's not a question of clear-cut morality. He doesn't have to refuse the food. It's not that he's making a big public protest about this. This is something he does in secret and in private that the king of Babylon will never know about. But it is important that Daniel knows where his loyalty is and where his allegiance is, even if he's the only one at this point who knows that. And to give his loyalty away, his allegiance away, that would really defile him and spoil him. It's not easy for him to refuse the food. It's actually a risky thing to do, because if he gets found out, well, he asks the main official, the guy in charge, and he won't help. He's scared. The king will chop off his head. And so he won't go along with it. So then he asks the kind of junior guard to do it, and the junior guard needs quite a lot of persuasion. Daniel has to say, look, the junior guard said, well, people are going to find out. They're going to notice if you're not eating most of the food that you're supposed to be eating. You're just going to look kind of pale and tired, and that will give it away. And he said, well, let's try it out. Let's test it. Let's just give it a period of time and see if I look better or worse by the end of it. And the great thing is that it works out, because God is in control and because God rules. Chapter 1, verse 9. Now God had caused the official to show favor and compassion to Daniel. God was behind that sympathy and support that he gets from the people in charge. Or verse 15, at the end of the 10 days, they looked healthier and better nourished than any of the young men who ate the royal food. Now, I think vegetarians here will try and campaign here and say, of course he looked better and healthier because he was only eating vegetables. I think probably the text is trying to say this is a way that God intervened and showed that God was really in control by making this test work out so well. Even here, even in the heart of enemy headquarters, even in the control room in Babylon, God is overruling what happens. Well, will you and I resolve to say no? Is there something in our lives? We won't always be presented with a clear-cut moral decision. We won't always be required to make a big public protest. But we do need to know where our hearts are. There need to be ways that we're different from people who are not believers. There need to be times when we say, no, I'm not just one of them. My loyalty and my heart belongs to God and to God alone. What might that look like for you, even if it's a quiet thing that you just do for yourself? How will you know that you belong to God and God alone? God rules then when we resolve to say no. And God rules when we receive God's word. God speaks through Daniel and through his word in the Bible. And this is introducing us to Daniel in that way as well. So verse 17, To these four young men, God gave knowledge and understanding of all kinds of literature and learning, and Daniel could understand visions and dreams of all kinds. At the end of the time set by the king to bring them into his service, the chief official presented them to Nebuchadnezzar. The king talked with them and found none equal to Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, so they entered the king's service. In every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king questioned them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters in his whole kingdom. So they get to their final exams at the end of their training course, and you see again that God rules, that God is in charge. We're told that God is the one who gave them success in that. Verse 17, God is the one who enabled them to have knowledge and understanding of all the things that they were taught. Better knowledge, better understanding than not only their other students, but even the experts, anyone the king could find in the whole kingdom. He tended to go to people who were enchanters and magicians. Perhaps not very surprising then that he didn't find a huge amount of wisdom from that kind of slightly superstitious approach that they had. But when he goes to Daniel and his friends, they have been given a much better grasp, a much better knowledge, a much better understanding than these other alternatives. And notice in verse 17, all four of them do well. All four of them are given by God understanding of all kinds of learning and literature. But Daniel is the one who is given something extra, a special gift that is just for him. Verse 17, Daniel could understand visions and dreams of all kinds. That's going to be really important in the book of Daniel. Almost every chapter has a dream or a vision in it. There's some great stories in the book, but as the book goes on, the stories kind of give way to dreams and visions. Because it turns out that the really important thing here is what God is revealing, what God is showing through the prophet that he's chosen. That's why the book of Daniel is called the book of Daniel, not the book of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, the book of Daniel, because Daniel is the one person in that generation that God is speaking through. That's why his words and his book have got into the Bible as scripture. Because the message that he is preaching is the message of an everlasting kingdom. The everlasting kingdom that leads to Jesus. There's actually a hint of that in the final sentence, verse 21. And Daniel remained there until the first year of King Cyrus. Well, King Cyrus is the guy who brings Babylon to an end. This is the very end of we just got to hear the beginning of the Babylonian Empire. We've got this terrifying guy, Nebuchadnezzar. He looks powerful, but actually, Daniel will outlast him. And Daniel will be there when his kingdom has gone. And the message that he preaches is the message of the everlasting kingdom of Jesus Christ. In a little while, we'll have bread and wine to remember the death of Jesus. And we're remembering a king who did not always look as if he ruled. A king who was willing to suffer and to die for us. And we're part of that kingdom if we put our trust in Jesus. And it won't always look as if that kingdom is winning and rules. But it is the same Jesus who rose from the dead, and is the same Jesus who will outlast every other king and every other kingdom. So it's going to be worth hearing what that king says through the prophet Daniel, taking on board those visions and dreams, how they speak to us, how they challenge us, how they encourage us. It's going to be worth putting the time and the effort into that on Sundays in our small groups. Because in the end, he's the one with all the power. He's the only king who lasts forever.